The telephone on the bar buzzed, and the secretary picked it up on the second ring. He murmured into it, "Oui, oui, d'accord," and hung up. "Ma baronne, the aircraft is refueled and ready to depart." "We will leave immediately," she told him, and then to Peter, "I am sorry." "When will I see you?" he asked. She shrugged, and a little shadow passed over her eyes. "It is difficult. I am not sure. I will telephone you. But now I must go, Peter. Adieu, my darling." When she had gone, Peter stood at the windows overlooking the airfield. It was a glorious spring afternoon. The early marguerites were blooming wild along the grassy verges of the main runways, like scattered gold sovereigns, and a flock of black birds hopped amongst them, probing and picking for insects, completely undisturbed by the jet shriek of a departing Swiss air flight. Peter ran his mind swiftly over the meeting, carefully identifying and isolating the exact moment when she had changed, when she had ceased to be Magda Altman and become Caliph. There was no doubt left now. Had there ever been, he wondered, or had it merely been his wish to find doubt? Now he must harden himself to the act. It would be difficult, much more difficult than he had believed possible. Not once had they been alone, he realized. Always the two grey wolves had hovered around them. It was just another sign of her new wariness. He wondered if they would ever be alone together again, now that she was alerted. Then abruptly he realized that she had not said au revoir, my darling, but instead she had said adieu, my darling. Was there a warning in that? A subtle hint of death? For if Caliph suspected him, he knew what her immediate reaction must be. Was she threatening, or had she merely discarded him, as Kingston Parker had warned that she would? He could not understand the desolate feeling that swamped him at the thought that he might never see her again, except through his gun sight. He stood staring out of the window, wondering how his career and his life had begun to disintegrate about him since first he had heard the name Caliph. A polite voice at his shoulder startled him, and he turned to the airport sub-manager. "They are calling the KLM flight to Brussels now, General Stride." Peter roused himself with a sigh and picked up his overcoat and the crocodile skin Hermes briefcase that had been a gift from the woman he must kill. There was such a volume of correspondence and urgent business piling the long desk in his new office that Peter had excuse to put aside the detailed planning of the preemptive strike against Caliph. To his mild surprise, he found himself enjoying the jostle and haggle, the driving pace and the challenge of the marketplace. He enjoyed pitting wits and judgment against other sharp and pointed minds. He enjoyed the human interaction, and for the first time understood the fascination which this type of life had exerted over his brother Stephen. 3 days after arriving back at his desk, the Iranian Air Force made their first order of the Namco Kestrel missiles. 120 units, over $150 million worth. It was a good feeling, and could grow stronger, could finally become addictive, he realized. He had always looked upon money as rather a nuisance, those degrading and boring sessions with bank managers and clerks of the income tax department. But now he realized that this was a different kind of money. He had glimpsed the world in which Caliph existed, and realized how once a human being became accustomed to manipulating this kind of money, then dreams of godlike power became believable, capable of being transmuted into reality. He could understand, but could never forgive. And so at last, 7 days after his return to Brussels, he forced himself to face up to what he must do. Magda Altman had withdrawn. She had made no further contact since that brief and unsatisfactory hour at Orly Airport. He must go to her, he realized. He had lost his special inside position, which would have made the task easier. He could still get close enough to kill her, of that he was certain, just as he had the opportunity to do so at Orly. However, if he did it that way, it would be suicidal. If he survived the swift retribution of her guards, there would be the slower but inexorable processes of the law. He knew, without bothering to consider it too deeply, that he would be unable to use the defence of the Caliph story. No court would believe it. It would sound like the rantings of a maniac without the support of Atlas or the intelligence systems of America and Britain. That support would not be forthcoming, of that he was certain. If he killed Caliph, they would be delighted, but they would let him go to the guillotine without raising a voice in his defence. He could imagine the moral indignation of the civilised world if they believed that an unorthodox organisation such as Atlas was employing assassins to murder the prominent citizens of a foreign and friendly nation. No. He was on his own completely. Parker had made that quite clear. And Peter realised that he did not want to die. He was not prepared to sacrifice his life to stop Caliph. Not unless there was no other way. There had to be another way, of course. As he planned it, he thought of the victim only as Caliph, never as Magda Altman. That way he was able to bring a cold detachment to the problem, the where, the when, and the how of it. He had complicated the task by replanning her personal security, and his major concern when he did so had been to make her movements as unpredictable as possible. Her social calendar was as closely guarded as a secret of state. There were never any forward press reports of attendance at public or state events. If she were invited to dine at the Elysee Palace, the fact was reported the day after, not the day before. But there were some annual events that she would never miss. Together they had discussed these weaknesses in her personal security. "Oh, Peter, you cannot make a convict of me." She had laughed in protest when he mentioned them. "I have so few real pleasures. You would not take them from me, would you?" The first seasonal showing of Yves Saint Laurent's collections, that she would never miss, or the Grand Semaine of the spring racing season, which culminates with the running of the Grand Prix de Paris and Longchamp. This year she had high hopes of victory with her lovely and courageous bay mare, Ice Leopard. She would be there. It was absolutely certain. Peter began to draw up the list of possible killing grounds, and then crossed off all but the most likely. The estate at La Pierre Benete, for instance. It had the advantage of being familiar ground for Peter. With a soldier's eye, he had noticed fields of fire across the wide terraced lawns that dropped down to the lake. There were stances for a sniper in the forests along the far edge of the lake, and in the little wooded knoll to the north of the house, which commanded the yard and the stables. However, the estate was well guarded, and even there the victim's movements were unpredictable. It would be possible to lie in ambush for the week when she was in Rome or New York. Then again, the escape route was highly risky, through a sparsely populated area with only two access roads, both easily blocked by swift police action. No, La Pierre Benite was crossed from the list. In the end, Peter was left with the two venues that had first sprung to mind: the members' enclosure at Longchamp, or Yves Saint Laurent's premises at 46 Avenue Victor Hugo. Both had the advantages of being public and crowded, circumstances favouring pickpockets and assassins, Peter thought wryly. Both had multiple escape routes, and crowds into which the fugitive could blend. There were good stances for a sniper in the grandstands and buildings overlooking the members' enclosure and the saddling paddock at Longchamp, or in the multi-storied buildings opposite No. 46 in the Avenue Victor Hugo. It would probably be necessary to rent an office suite in one of the buildings, with the attendant risks, even if he used a false name, which put the probability slightly in favour of the racecourse. However, Peter delayed the final decision until he had a chance to inspect each site critically. There was one last advantage in doing it this way. It would be a standoff kill. He would be spared the harrowing moments of a kill at close range with handgun or knife or garrote. There would be the detached view of Caliph through the lens of a telescopic sight. The flattened perspectives and the altered colour balances always made for a feeling of unreality. The intervening distance obviated the need for confrontation. He would never have to watch the green light go out in those magnificent eyes, nor hear the last exhalation of breath through the soft and perfectly sculptured lips that had given him so much joy. Quickly, he thrust those thoughts aside. They weakened his resolve. even though the rage and the lust for vengeance had not abated. If he could get one of the Thor 222 sniper rifles, it would be the perfect tool for his task. With the extra-long, accurized barrels designed for use with match-grade ammunition and the new laser sights, the weapon could throw a 3-inch group at 700 yards. The sniper had only to depress the button on the top of the stock with the forefinger of his left hand. This activated the laser, and the beam swept precisely down the projected flight of the bullet. It would show as a bright white coin the size of a silver dime. The sniper looked for the spot of light through the telescopic lens of the sight, and the moment it was exactly on the target, he pressed the trigger. Even an unskilled marksman could hardly miss with this sight. In Peter's hands, it would be infallible, and Colin Noble would give him one. Not only would Colin Noble give him one, hell, he would probably have it delivered with the compliments of the American Marine Corps by the senior military attaché of the U.S. Embassy in Paris. Yet Peter found himself drawing out the moment of action, going over his plan so often and with such a critical eye that he knew he was procrastinating. The 16th day after his return to Brussels was a Friday. Peter spent the morning on the NATO range north of the city at a demonstration of the new electronic shield that Namco had developed to foil the radar guidance on short-range anti-tank missiles. Then he helicoptered back with the three Iranian officers who had attended the demonstration, and they lunched at Épaule de Mouton, a magnificent and leisurely meal. Peter still felt guilty spending 3 hours at the lunch table, so he worked until 8 o'clock that evening on the missile contracts. It was long after dark when he left through the rear entrance, taking all his usual precautions against the chance that Caliph had an assassin waiting for him in the dark streets. He never left at the same time, nor followed the same route, and this evening he bought the evening papers from a marchand du tabac in the Grand Place and stopped to read them at one of the outdoor cafes overlooking the square. He began with the English papers, and the headlines filled the page from one side to the other. Black and bold, they declared. Drop in price of crude oil. Peter sipped the whiskey thoughtfully as he read the article through, turning to page 6 for the continuation. Then he crumpled the newsprint in his lap and stared at the passing jostle of spring tourists and early evening revellers. Caliph had achieved her first international triumph. From now on there would be no bounds to her ruthless rampage of power and violence. Peter knew he could delay no longer. He made the go decision then, and it was irrevocable. He would arrange to visit London on Monday morning. There was excuse enough for that. He would ask Colin to meet him at the airport, and it would be necessary to tell him of his plan. He knew he could expect full support. Then he could move on to Paris for the final reconnaissance and choice of killing ground. There were still 2 weeks until the showing of the spring collections, 2 weeks to plan it so carefully that there would be no chance of failure. He felt suddenly exhausted, as though the effort of decision had required the last of his reserves. So exhausted that the short walk back to the hotel seemed daunting. He ordered another whiskey and drank it slowly before he could make the effort. Namco maintained 2 permanent suites at the Hilton for their senior executives and other important visitors. Peter had not yet made the effort of finding private accommodation in the city, and he was living out of the smaller of the 2 suites. It was merely a place to wash and sleep and leave his clothes, for he could not shake off the feeling of impermanence, of swiftly changing circumstances by which he found himself surrounded. "My books are in storage again," he thought with a little chill of loneliness. His collection of rare and beautiful books had been in storage for the greater part of his life, as he roamed wherever his duty took him, living out of barracks and hotel rooms. His books were his only possessions, and as he thought about them now, he was filled with an unaccustomed longing to have a base, a place that was his own, and immediately he thrust it aside, smiling cynically at himself as he strode through the streets of another foreign city, alone again. "Must be old age catching up with me," he decided. There had never been time for loneliness before. But now. Unaccountably, he remembered Magda Altman coming into his arms and saying quietly, "Oh, Peter, I have been alone for so long." The memory stopped him dead, and he stood in the light of one of the street lamps, a tall figure in a belted trench coat, with a gaunt and haunted face. A blonde girl with lewdly painted lips sauntered towards him down the sidewalk, pausing to murmur a proposition, and it brought Peter back to the present. "Merci." He shook his head in curt refusal and walked on.